Lecture 7, The Mechanics of Writing Dialogue.
Just as people do in real life, people in fiction talk to each other. And like real people, fictional characters have all sorts of reasons for talking to each other: to convey information, to persuade, to dissuade, to inspire, to manipulate, to tell the truth, to lie, to seduce, to enrage, to comfort, to amuse. But as with everything else in fiction, it isn't enough just to reproduce the way that real people talk. In my first lecture about character, I talked about how fictional people are often more memorable than real people because they are less complicated and more vivid. By the same token, dialogue in fiction can be more vivid and memorable than real speech, and for many of the same reasons that characters are more vivid than real people. In real life, speech and conversation can be rambling, ungrammatical, incoherent, ambiguous, repetitive, inconclusive, and dull. Fiction writers often mimic these effects to make characters sound more lifelike, but in the end, fictional speech can only suggest real speech, not reproduce it. If you've ever read a transcript of a real conversation, you'll have noticed that it didn't read anything like the speech we see in fiction. If you compare the speech of the real conspirators in the Watergate tapes, for example, with the conspirators in a Shakespeare history play like Julius Caesar, you'll find that Shakespeare's characters sound much more interesting and complex than Richard Nixon's staff. If people in fiction talk the way people do in real life, nobody would read it or believe it. Instead, fictional speech is more focused and coherent than real speech, just as fictional characters are more immediately comprehensible than real people. Even if fictional speech is ungrammatical and rambling, it still has to be ungrammatical and rambling in an interesting and purposeful way. I want to emphasize that second word, purposeful. In real life, sometimes we talk just to pass the time, or because we're nervous, or just to keep from being bored or rude. But in fiction, dialogue has to have a purpose, usually to evoke character, to advance the plot, or to provide exposition. Sometimes it does all three at once. This does not mean that dialogue is purely utilitarian or that it can't be entertaining for its own sake. And the fact that dialogue is purposeful doesn't require that characters always say what they mean. Some of the best dialogue, especially the dialogue that evokes character or the relationship between two characters, can be wonderfully oblique. Sometimes what a character isn't saying is more meaningful than what he or she is saying. I'll talk about that in the next lecture. Meanwhile, in this first lecture about dialogue, I want to talk first, very briefly, about the mechanics of writing dialogue. Then I want to talk about some basic techniques for using dialogue tags, for mixing speech and action, speech and exposition, and so on. Along the way, as painlessly as possible, I'm going to sneak in some actual grammar and punctuation. It's been my experience that even very good writers are sometimes unclear on the actual rules for writing dialogue. Unless you're writing some sort of postmodernist narrative where you're trying to call the reader's attention to the mechanics of the text, you want dialogue to be seamlessly integrated into the rest of the text, and that's more easily accomplished if you have mastered the rules and stick to them. If you glance at a page of fiction from a slight distance, close enough to see the paragraphs but too far away to read the words, it's impossible to tell if the text you're looking at is exposition or action or character description. From a distance, these different sorts of passages all look the same. Action and exposition are differentiated from each other only through context and by internal cues in the text itself. But even from across the room, you can identify a passage of dialogue by the choppy paragraph breaks, and, if you look closer, by the use of quotation marks and some special rules of punctuation. These special rules for dialogue serve two fundamental purposes: to separate direct quotations from the rest of the narrative, and to make it clear for the reader just who is speaking at any given time. The vast majority of fiction published since the 18th century has followed these rules, with some variations. But from time to time, you'll come across some very good writers and some very good books where dialogue is punctuated in a non-standard way. In some books, Each line of dialogue is marked with a dash at the beginning of each line instead of by quotation marks. Sometimes dialogue doesn't use quotation marks at all. Instead, it is set off from the rest of the narrative only by a paragraph break. And sometimes, the dialogue isn't even set off by paragraphing. Instead, it's buried right in the middle of a passage, in which case you have to guess that it's dialogue from the context. As I say, there are some very good writers who have written dialogue in an unconventional way. There are long sections of dialogue in William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, for example, that don't use quotation marks. And The Sound and the Fury is one of the greatest American novels ever written. Another great writer who tends not to use quotation marks is Cormac McCarthy, the author of Blood Meridian and The Road. But great writers don't always make good role models. And on the whole, and with very few exceptions, writing dialogue without quotation marks or paragraph breaks is usually pretentious and often annoying. Think of it in terms of a cost-benefit analysis and ask yourself the following question. Is what you're gaining by not using standard punctuation for dialogue worth the extra effort you're making for the reader? On the one hand, in the case of The Sound and the Fury, the lack of quotation marks helps evoke the mental disability of the character Benji in the passages that are told from his point of view. On the other hand, even though I yield to no one in my admiration of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, I don't really think that the book would have been diminished if he'd used quotation marks. Most of what you need to know about the mechanics of writing dialogue can be summed up in a few rules. For examples of all these, pick up the nearest work of fiction you have to hand, or at least the nearest one that isn't written by William Faulkner or Cormac McCarthy. Find a few pages that are made up mostly of dialogue. You should be able to find most of the kinds of sentences I'm about to describe. The first rule is that all direct quotations, namely the exact words of a character, should be set apart from the rest of the text by quotation marks. The second rule is that every time a new character speaks or the speaker changes, his or her first line of dialogue should be set apart with a paragraph break. Also, the very beginning of a direct quotation should always begin with a capital letter. Now remember that I said that the rules of punctuation serve two purposes, to set dialogue apart from the rest of the narrative and to identify who is speaking at any given time. The first purpose is served by quotation marks and the paragraph breaks. The second purpose is served by identifying each speaker with something called a dialogue tag. In its most basic form, a dialogue tag is simply the name of the character or a pronoun standing in for the name, plus some variation on the verb said. He said, she said, Bob exclaimed, Elaine whispered, and so on. The rules of punctuating dialogue tags get a little tricky, but I'll lay them out quickly. The first rule is that the dialogue tag is not part of the actual quotation, so it should never be included within the quotation marks. But sometimes a dialogue tag comes in the middle of the quoted sentence. And when that happens, the first half of the quotation is set off by a comma and a quotation mark. The dialogue tag is followed with a comma, and the second half of the sentence begins with a quotation mark and a lowercase letter. However, if a dialogue tag appears between two complete sentences, then the dialogue tag ends with a period, and the second sentence starts with a capital letter. That was quick, and I hope relatively painless. If any of it is confusing, any good grammar guide will explain the rules of punctuating dialogue in more detail than I can here. An even better way to learn them is simply to model what you do after what your favorite writer does, assuming your favorite writer isn't Cormac McCarthy. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, let's talk about when to use dialogue tags, what sort of dialogue tags you should use, and how to mix dialogue with action and exposition. Unlike the rules of punctuation I just talked about, these are just tips, not rules. None of what I'm about to say is set in stone or is absolute. Other writers or writing teachers might disagree with them, and there are always exceptions and complications. These represent the rules of thumb that I use when I'm writing dialogue, and I think they represent more or less standard practice for most modern fiction writers. The first rule of thumb is that dialogue tags are necessary for three reasons. One, to introduce a character who is speaking for the first time, two, to identify the speakers when two or more people are speaking, or three, to get across necessary information or a bit of context that isn't clear from the dialogue itself. Let's take these three reasons one at a time, starting with introducing a character with a dialogue tag. You use a dialogue tag when you're introducing a character for the first time or when you're returning to a character at the beginning of a new chapter or scene. This is the most self-evident use of a dialogue tag. You want to tell the reader who's speaking. But even in this case, there can be exceptions. Say, for example, you open a scene with a single character walking alone into a setting, a woman coming ashore on a desert island after a shipwreck, say. You might write a paragraph or two about her struggling through the surf and struggling onto the beach. Given that she's the only person in sight, the first thing she says, "Is anybody here," for example, or "Thank God I'm alive," would not necessarily need a dialogue tag because she's the only person present. Another instance when you might not need a dialogue tag at the very beginning of a scene would be if you were trying for a dramatic effect, like this. "Look out!" The detective turned just in time to see a large guy behind him swinging a baseball bat in his direction. That's a little crude, but you get the idea. The intent of this opening gambit is to immerse the reader right away in a dangerous and suspenseful situation. As a result, you don't need to know immediately who yelled, "Look out!" Though this kind of opening sets up the expectation that the speaker will soon be identified. So perhaps this isn't so much an example of a dialogue without a tag as it is an example of dialogue with a deferred tag. Let's move to the second reason for deploying dialogue tags, which is to use them when you're writing a scene that has two or more speakers in it. The usual practice in this case is to identify each speaker with his or her first line of dialogue. Again, however, there can be exceptions. And if you've got more than two speakers in a scene, then you're going to have to use more dialogue tags just to keep them straight. Simply identifying the speaker or keeping several speakers straight are the most mechanical uses of dialogue tags. But now we come to the third reason for using dialogue tags, namely to provide some context or nuance that isn't conveyed by the dialogue itself, or to clear up an ambiguity. This use requires more judgment and skill, but it is just as essential. Let's take a very simple example. "I love you," she said. In most cases, the context for this simple but emotional statement is likely to be clear from whatever comes before or after it in the narrative. But it is easy to imagine a number of different ways that statement could be said by the speaker or heard by the character at whom it's directed, not to mention a number of ways it could be understood by the reader. Assuming you don't want the declaration to be ambiguous, there are simple ways of using the dialogue tag to make the statement clear. For example, "I love you," she laughed. "I love you," she sobbed. "I love you," she said casually. Or, instead of altering the dialogue tag, you could italicize one of the words in the dialogue itself to show the speaker's emphasis. Each one of the following versions is subtly different from the others. "I love you," she said. "I love you," she said. "I love you," she said. These examples should make clear that how and when you use a dialogue tag and what sort of dialogue tag you use depends almost entirely on the context of the scene. A little bit later in this lecture, I'll explore that idea in more detail. First, having talked about when dialogue tags are necessary, let's talk about when they're not. My next rule of thumb about dialogue tags is that you should use them sparingly and that you should keep them as simple as possible. How you define sparingly varies from writer to writer, from story to story, and even from scene to scene within a story. But on the whole, the more you can rely on the actual speech of the characters to relay information or convey emotion, the better. In fact, on the whole, you should only use dialogue tags when it would otherwise be impossible to tell who is speaking, or, as I was just saying, when the context needs clarification. But when I say use dialogue tags sparingly, I don't mean too sparingly. On the one hand, you don't want to be obtrusive and redundant, hammering the reader with superfluous "he saids" or "she saids" or "he sobbed" or "she whispered." But on the other hand, you don't want the reader to get confused. You want to strike a balance between two goals. On the one hand, you want the character's actual words to carry the weight of the conversation as much as possible. On the other hand, you don't want the reader to lose track of who's saying what. If you have a conversation between two characters that goes on for less than a page, you can probably get away with identifying the speakers at the beginning and then not mentioning them again. Here's an example. "Are you going to Miriam's party?" Mary asked. "I don't know," said Glenn. "I haven't made up my mind." "Oh, for heaven's sake, are you still mad at her?" "I guess, a little." "You're being silly. Get over it." In this case, it's easy not to use too many dialogue tags for two reasons. One is that it is a short exchange. The other is that it's reasonably clear from what the characters are saying just who is speaking at every moment, because one character, Mary, is taking the opposite position from the other character, Glenn. But even if only two people are talking, a dialogue tag is often necessary later in the conversation. This is especially the case if the conversation goes on for a long time and it isn't broken up with a lot of action or exposition. Detective stories, for example, often feature long conversations between an investigator and a suspect or a witness. The investigator asks the suspect a long series of questions and the suspect answers. Some writers introduce the two characters at the start and then dispense with dialogue tags entirely. They're acting on the assumption that it's clear from the dialogue itself who is speaking, simply by virtue of the fact that the detective is usually asking the questions and the other character is usually answering them. And this often works pretty well, especially if the internal cues in each line of dialogue are clear. Sometimes, the detective comes from a different social class than the suspect. And in that case, you can tell the difference because the detective speaks in one dialect and the suspect speaks in a different dialect, though the use of dialect raises issues of its own that I'll talk about in the next lecture. But even if the writer is careful to distinguish between the two speakers, sometimes a reader can get confused about just who is saying what, especially during a long exchange. I've certainly had this experience, and I'm sure you have too. There have been times when I've had to go back to the first moment where the speakers were identified and count forward by twos or however many characters there were. In cases like this, it might have helped if the writer had thrown in a dialogue tag every few lines, like a signpost, so we didn't have to keep track on our fingers. Another thing to remember about dialogue tags is that when you do use them, you want to keep them as simple as possible and to avoid over-explaining them. Again, some other writers might say differently, but it's my feeling that you want to avoid verbs that are too descriptive. As I've already said, you want the speech itself to carry as much of the meaning as possible, without unnecessary help from a dialogue tag. In my example about the simple sentence, "I love you," a few moments ago, I suggested that you could clear up the ambiguity of such a statement with a stronger verb than a simple "she said." You might say "she sobbed" instead, which gives you a more definitive impression of the speaker's emotion and intent. Or you might add an adverb to the dialogue tag for the same reason. Again, "I love you," she said casually, is clearer and less ambiguous than simply "I love you," she said. But if you have a piece of dialogue where the meaning itself is sharper and more definitive, you might not need the stronger verb or adverb at all. For example, "You're a clumsy idiot," said the coach, is probably clear enough without any extra emphasis, depending on what else is going on in the narrative. Another example, "You're a clumsy idiot," snarled the coach, seems to me to remain within the bounds of necessity, since it tells us something about the coach's vehemence and anger that we might not have gotten from the first example. However, "You're a clumsy idiot," said the coach disparagingly, is simply unnecessary. It's already clear from what the coach said that he's disparaging whomever he's talking to. We don't need the dialogue tag to tell us that the coach is being disparaging. We can hear it for ourselves. And the sentence, "You're a clumsy idiot," snarled the coach disparagingly, is just over the top. Any one of these examples, except maybe the last one, could still be permissible depending on the context. But you need to walk a fine line between leaving the dialogue too ambiguous on the one hand and over-explaining it on the other. When using dialogue tags, less is more. I'll say it again. You want the actual words the character is speaking to carry as much of the dialogue's meaning as possible. Now here's my final rule of thumb. The most graceful and evocative way to write dialogue is not to separate it out from the rest of the narrative, but to interweave it with the narrative as much as possible. In real life, people don't necessarily stop whatever else they're doing to talk to each other, but they carry on conversations while they're doing all sorts of things. And even if they do stop and concentrate on their conversation, each participant in that conversation is taking note of the other person's facial expression, gestures, and body language. Dialogue usually works best when it is an integral part of a scene that combines thoughts, actions, and the speech of your characters. To show you what I mean, here's a passage of dialogue from my novel Next, in which my main character, Kevin, who is an academic editor, is having a meeting with Eileen, the professor who has just become his new boss. Kevin is trying to present the budget for the publication program he manages, while Eileen is standing behind her desk looking at carpet swatches for her new office. Here's the bare bones of the dialogue, just the direct quotations themselves, with the bare minimum of dialogue tags. "I've seen you at the gym," Eileen said. "Yes," Kevin said. "I assume that's your lunch hour?" "Yeah, I play a pickup game with some guys 2-3 days a week." "So the game itself lasts, what, 45 minutes? "Maybe a little less." "So by the time you walk over there, change your clothes, warm up, play the game, shower, and walk back to your office, that's what? An hour and a quarter? An hour and a half?" "Come on, Eileen, I see you at the gym all the time." "I'm not on the clock. May I call you Kevin?" "Of course." "Kevin, you're not salaried like I'm salaried. Do we understand each other?" "Perfectly." "I'll look over your budget, and we'll have a talk about it soon," said Eileen. Now, even with just the speech and nothing else, this is a reasonably clear passage of dialogue. It's obvious what's happening. Eileen is being imperious and condescending, and Kevin is being nervous and defensive. Even without any description of their actions or gestures or thoughts, it gets the point across. And even without being told anything else about them, you get a pretty vivid idea of what sort of people Kevin and Eileen are. Now, here's the scene as it appeared in the book. In this version, we have a bit more description of what Kevin and Eileen are actually doing as they speak. More importantly, because the novel is told entirely from Kevin's point of view, we have access to Kevin's thoughts. I'm also including a bit of the paragraph just before the exchange to show how the dialogue arises out of this particular situation. Eileen continued to stand and sort through swatches while Kevin delivered his little State of the Pubs program address, complete with a spreadsheet printed out that morning from Excel. "I've seen you at the gym," she said, still standing. "Yes, Kevin brightened. She remembers me." "I assume that's your lunch hour?" Still, she wouldn't meet his eye, but instead glanced from a wine-red swatch in her left hand to a blue one in her right. "Yeah," he said casually, "I play a pickup game with some guys 2-3 days a week." "So," she said, laying down the blue swatch and picking up a bluer one, "the game itself lasts, what, 45 minutes? "Maybe a little less. Uh-oh. So by the time you walk over there, change your clothes, warm up, play the game, shower, and sauna," thought Kevin, but he knew better than to say so. "And walk back to your office, that's what, an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half?" Still, she wasn't looking at him. "Come on, Eileen," Kevin said collegially. "I see you at the gym all the time." "I'm not on the clock." She let both swatches fall from her hands in disgust and then said, with icy politesse, "May I call you Kevin?" "Of course." He could feel himself dwindling in the chair. "Kevin?" Eileen fixed him with glacially blue eyes. "You're not salaried like I'm salaried." His feet dangled above the carpet. His head shrank into his collar. "Do we understand each other?" Eileen said. "Perfectly," said Kevin, the incredible shrinking man. The meeting was over. "I'll look over your budget," she said as he walked, vibrating with rage, across the crummy old carpet to the door. "And we'll have a talk about it soon." Now, the second version is not necessarily better than the first, but it does have the advantage of being more complete, more evocative, and more complex. The first version is shorter and sharper, but it doesn't give you any visual cues about the setting of the character. Even though you can infer each character's state of mind from what he or she says, you can't know it for sure. The first version leaves a lot for the reader to fill in. On the other hand, the second version integrates the dialogue with the setting, with the physical presence of Kevin and Eileen, and with Kevin's thoughts. Take their very first exchange, for example. In the first version, Eileen simply says, "I've seen you at the gym." And Kevin simply replies, "Yes." It's direct and clear, but it tells you very little about each character. It isn't until we get further into that version of the dialogue that we start to understand how it's going to go badly for Kevin. Now look at the second version again. "I've seen you at the gym," she said, still standing. Yes, Kevin brightened. She remembers me. The second version is only 5 words longer than the first version, but already we're getting very subtle, almost subliminal cues that this conversation won't end well. The fact that Eileen remains standing should be a warning sign for Kevin. Instead, he misreads her mood, and he brightens, thinking that she remembers him from the gym. This implies that he didn't expect her to remember seeing him there, and it further implies that he expects the fact that they both use the gym to be common ground between them. We don't get any of this from the first version, or at least we only get the barest hint of it. Then, as the second version progresses, we learn along the way, through some very simple details, that Eileen can be cold, at least with a subordinate. She speaks with icy politesse, and she looks at Kevin with glacially blue eyes. We can also infer that she has little respect for Kevin from the fact that she does not give him her full attention, but continues to sort through the carpet swatches while she talks to him. But this isn't just busy work in order to show the character doing something. These particular gestures act in counterpoint to her actual dialogue. They show her physically judging something as she starts to verbally judge Kevin, until, at the moment she lowers the boom on him, she lets both swatches fall from her hands in disgust. Her gesture reinforces her disapproval of Kevin's long lunch hours. And by the same token, we learn much more about Kevin in the second version. Since the novel is told from his point of view, we have access to his thoughts. And as the dialogue progresses, we don't have to infer his anxiety the way we do in the first version of the passage. Instead, we can actually see it happening in real time. We can hear his attempts to keep it light, such as when he speaks casually or collegially. We can see how his anxiety is expressed at first in little silent asides like, uh-oh, or he knew better than to say so. And finally, we see his anxiety expressed as comic hyperbole, such as when he starts to feel himself diminish under her gaze, becoming the incredible shrinking man. The dialogue and his silent internal monologue reinforce each other. His attempt to keep it light only heightens his anxiety, and his anxiety makes his excuses seem even more feeble. In the first version, with the dialogue alone, we are witnessing a conversation. But in the second version, we are participating in it, at least from Kevin's point of view. We feel how he starts to feel smaller under Eileen's icy gaze, and we feel him vibrating with repressed rage as he leaves her office. And that effect is the result of interweaving the dialogue with visual cues and physical sensations, and by giving the reader access to at least one of the character's thoughts. It would be easy to take the same exchange and write it from Eileen's point of view, showing us what Kevin looks like to her, cringing in his chair, and we'll talk more about that in the lectures about point of view. In my second lecture on dialogue, we'll be looking at examples from a wide variety of novels and stories, including David Copperfield, The Maltese Falcon, and Anna Karenina, as well as Toni Morrison's Beloved, Elmore Leonard's Cuba Libre, and Alice Munro's story, Walker Brothers Cowboy. In the meantime, here's an exercise you can use to help you think about writing dialogue and incorporating it into the rest of the narrative. It's very simple. Just write out a dialogue, say half a page or a page, between two people who are at cross purposes to each other. One is in love and the other isn't, for example, or one wants something that the other doesn't want to give up. In the first version, write it like a play, with no dialogue tags or even the names of the characters, just the dialogue itself. Then take that dialogue and start layering in more stuff. Do a version with basic dialogue tags, then a version with slightly more descriptive dialogue tags, then a version with a little bit of action and physical description, then a version with access to the character's thoughts, and so on. I think you'll find that each different version has a very different effect. Depending on what effect you prefer, you may find that the simplest version is the best, but you might find that one of the more complicated versions is. Which one you choose depends on what purpose the dialogue has in the larger narrative, and that is what I'm going to talk about in the next lecture.